Get ready for a little surf and turf action on Midnight Run Through, a podcast miniseries devoted to celebrating the 1988 contemporary classic action buddy comedy Midnight Run, written by George Gallo and directed by Martin Brest. Co-hosted by me, Jen Johans from Watch With Jen.
And me, Blake Howard from One Hate Minute Productions.
Each week, we'll explore the film we first bonded over when we became friends in 2019 by surfing through the incredible roster of guests from journalists to novelists and beyond who love it as much as we do, digging into Serrano's finances and Alonzo Mosley's FBI files. Come with us on Midnight Run Through as we crisscross the United States with the characters played by Robert De Niro, Charles Grodin, John Ashton, Yaphet Kotto, Dennis Farina, Philip Baker Hall, Joe Pantoliano, and company on screen. Today, our guests are...
Hi, my name is Adrian McKinty. I'm a crime writer originally from Northern Ireland, and for the last 3 years, I've been living in New York City.
But before we go any further, let's kick things off on Jack Walsh's old turf with the ultimate question.
Why were you so unpopular with the Chicago Police Department?
Well, because I didn't accept the payoffs from the mob, which is what you're supposed to do in Chicago. And that's how you live an easier life. Robert De Niro had that hard life, as did Frank Serpico in the NYPD. If they had just taken the path of least resistance, they would have had an easier life, but their morality wouldn't let them take the path of least resistance. So Bob De Niro has a lot of problems in Chicago PD, and Frank Serpico has a lot of problems in NYPD.
That's the first Serpico connection.
I know.
This is the first one on the show. Yeah, I like that too.
Little Pacino De Niro action.
A man after my own heart. Another reason to talk about Pacino and De Niro together. Adrian, tell us about Midnight Run. When did you see it? How did you see it? How often do you revisit it? Because I think folks who may have heard you talk before and say Watch With Jen, they know you are a voracious consumer of movies and you love watching stuff. But how did, and I think if the influence of Jen is always how many times have you watched Midnight Run? That's a great way that she, a cornerstone of many of her friendships. So how did you start watching Midnight Run and when did you encounter it?
I can tell you, I saw it in the cinema when I was a kid. So that when it came out, 88, 80.
Yes. Yep, 88.
So I would have been a kid and I saw it in the cinema. I knew nothing about it. I don't think I had seen Robert De Niro in anything.
Okay. Me neither. Yep.
I think this may have been my introduction to him. I certainly hadn't seen Taxi Driver or Raging Bull or anything like that. So I think this may have been my introduction to him. It was 100% my introduction to Charles Grodin. I'd never heard of him before. I obviously, not growing up in America, I had never seen him on Carson, where he's extremely famous from his appearances on Johnny Carson show. And then later on, he would play the same angry, slow burn character on David Letterman.
Yeah.
So I think for American audiences, it's quite a different experience.
I mean, it's kind of self-effacing,
you know,
entrance, I've
seen. Excuse me. Do you feel my pants? The lady, Amy Yazbek, mm-hmm. who's coming on later, felt my pants were disrespectful.
I don't know. I think they're fine if you're a log roller.
Were you offended by my pants?
Not a bit. No. Jeans are comfortable. I think jeans are
good.
Are
and
great.
You?
Just.
You wear pants?
Yes, I have pants on. It's really not necessary. Most of the time I'm back there.
Yes,
I could probably save a lot if I didn't wear them.
Your
let's
pants.
Let's work this out here. This is my first guest, who's currently starring and taking care of business. Then in parentheses it says with Jim Belushi. So is the correct billing co-starring or starring?
Taking Care of Business is probably the most entertaining picture I've done since Heaven Can Wait.
Did I miss a question somewhere in between? Did you answer something else before this? You're jumping ahead to the next question. You see, they have to come in order. I ask
not
the question,
really.
Then
no,
you answer the current question.
I have
question.
Certain things to say, and you have certain things
of course
to say.
We
I'm
do.
Interested.
Guy who's just simmering with intelligence, but also rage all the way through. And I think they go, oh, it's Robert De Niro playing a cop, you know, but an outsider cop wearing a leather jacket. Oh, he's not quite a cop. He's a bunny. So I think there would have been a lot of familiarity there. As for me, I kind of went in blind, not knowing either of those characters. And then I think the thing that I fell in love with was the tone. I still don't really know how to describe that tone because it's ironic, but it's also serious and it has a strong moral center all the way through. And there's these big action set pieces, but it's not really an action movie.
Action movies wish they had the action of Midnight Run, you know, it's big action.
The helicopter stuff, action is top notch.
Shit. They're not after me. Just kidding. I thought you threw those away. Always check the evidence, Marvin. Those are car keys.
There goes $100,000.
$100,000? Eddie was gonna pay you $100,000?
Why? What was he gonna pay you?
$25,000.
Oh.
Son of a bitch.
A road movie, and then it's also a buddy movie. So I couldn't get a hat, you know, buddies who are not really buddies, but become.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I couldn't get a handle on the tone. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up in the era of home video, and I watched a lot of films on home video, and especially for the cheaper ones, the tone is immediately apparent after 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But after 15 minutes of Midnight Run, you're still not really sure what type of film it is. And that's interesting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's so interesting. You're just going, wow. And also it's good because if you consume a lot of movies and especially in the 80s, or you basically know what's going to happen at the end.
Yes.
To all those 80s films, you just go, oh, I think, and you're right 90% of the time. Was Midnight Run, I was so confused. I had no clue what was going to happen at the end. I was absolutely baffled. I thought, wait, are they going to kill this guy? Are they going to kill both of them? Like, what? Because there was a real element of scary.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. With Serrano in the car with Grodin.
What's going to happen? I was really sorry. I had no clue what was going to happen at the end. And then I was so many surprises, like Joey Pants being I guess you got used to Joey Pants being the traitor because he played that same character about three or four more times, including The Matrix. Basically the guy that's not really on board with the rest of the team. But I hadn't seen him do that before in Midnight Run, so that was really surprising. And tonally super interesting. I couldn't put my finger on it. Character development, everything, just my introduction to De Niro, my introduction to Grodin. So yeah, I really loved it. And also it was also a little bit confusing. I'm guessing it was really popular and made money. But I wonder what it is when people came out of it. What did they tell their friends?
A good point.
Would you say, hey, I just saw this great action movie, buddy comedy?
Buddy comedy, maybe. Yeah, you're right. It came out on the same weekend as Die Hard.
Yeah.
So one of those movies had better word of mouth than the other.
Right. It came. What weekend was that? Die Hard came out in the summer. I that's right, isn't it?
Yeah, because it's a summer movie.
Because it was a setting, but a summer blockbuster.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, why didn't they just remember.
It's
Die Hard.
It's a Christmas movie. Yeah.
In Australia, it was, we got Die Hard a few months after the States. We were October. So we're heading into the end of the year. But I believe, I'll just have a look here. It was July 20th in the States was when Die Hard came out. So like obviously in Australia, we had like a massive run up of that movie and hearing how amazing it was before it finally got a theatrical release. And that was kind of the way of the world for the longest time with Oz. We would get things a few months after and sometimes still to this day. But it was a July movie. So it's like peak summer. Like you're right there. It's they used to think of the earlier May releases or April releases, the early summer, but like that Memorial weekend, late May, all the way through to July, anything that's released at that time is the big summer releases. So
we've got this Christmas movie, but we're going to release it in July, the hottest time of the year. And people will go, and they did. And then Die Hard 2 was also Christmas or snowy. Three. Yeah. Now, 3 was the
three
one.
Was set in summer with Sam Jackson.
Because they're sweating. It's him and Sam Jackson. They're sweating.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
That's like a Riddler movie. Basically.
Yeah, because it's Christmas. It's Christmas. You could steal City Hall, but it's in New York. It's like Christmas. You could steal City Hall, but it is in New York City. But yeah, so it would be a winter if it was.
So I guess Die Hard cleaned up at the box office and Midnight Run, but had a good word of mouth as well. I'm sure people say, oh, you got to go see this after you've seen Die Hard. Go see this. It's also interesting. Those two films, obviously, we didn't know there was going to be a series of Die Hard films, but such quality action entertainment, like with great character development, both of those movies, and great jokes, and just the great villains. Just a really professional job that they did in that era. In a way,
we are talking about Martin Brest and John McTiernan. Incredibly talented directors.
Yeah.
Behind
this
both
is right
of
after Beverly yep. Hills Cop. And,
right after Beverly
yeah.
Hills Cop, yep.
But I wonder if that you would get the budget and the time to make something like that today.
No.
That is not connected to a superhero franchise in any way. I just want to do this heist movie. I just want to do this buddy movie about bounty hunters. And people just go, well, how does that tie into Batman?
Actually, you can do it, but it's like three directors in the world.
Right.
That will get the cast. They get the, they can just cast like,
otherwise, it'd be a Gerard Butler direct to DVD kind of thing. Yeah, 100%.
Den of Thieves 6. Let's go. But it would. But it. Yeah, it's like when Toronto
has fallen.
Yeah, Toronto has fallen. Yes, Jen, that tickled me. It's like Scorsese, it's Tarantino, and it's kind of Nolan. Like those guys who can just go, I'm going to make this big gigantic movie, and I'm going to cast it with six of your favorite Academy Award winning and Academy Award nominated people, and they will literally just drop everything to do it.
And also, I also kind of don't blame the studios because in the 80s, they knew that if they made a quality movie under those circumstances, the audience would show up.
Yes.
Whereas now I think they think this is, wow, what, this $150 million movie about a bounty hunter with... I don't know if the people will come, and the people might not come.
Yeah,
You know, they actually absolutely might not come. They you're right. They show up for Oppenheimer, but would they come for generic crime thriller or something like that? And I don't know the answer. So you know, in a way, you sort of don't blame them. One of the things I wanted to talk about was Grodin. We touched on how I'd never heard of Grodin, but Americans had heard of him. Mm-hmm. But I remember after I saw Midnight Run, I went to my video store and I said, have you got any films by this guy? And I couldn't even remember his name. I said, the other guy from, and then said, oh yeah, Charles Grodin, you should watch that. And I had one of those like Tarantino-esque video store guys. And he said, you should watch this film. And he gave me The Heartbreak Kid. Yeah. And so days of watching Midnight Run, I watched The Heartbreak Kid. And I thought, and that film also blew my mind. I thought,
oh yeah,
what's the tone of this movie?
Dark as shit, like the breakup scene at the my god,
so ridiculously funny and dark. Yes. And
yeah,
it was one of those movies like Harold and Maude or something. You just go, how did this even get made?
Yes.
I just about made up my mind that I'm going to make this my home.
Oh, well, from what I've seen, I'd say you're a very determined young man.
I take that as a compliment, Mrs. Corcoran. Thank you. Well, I don't mind saying it. This is one of the finest meals that I've ever had.
Oh, thank you, Leonard. It's simple, you know. Mr. Corcoran doesn't really care for fancy food. Though I imagine you've tried just about every kind of exotic dish in New York.
Exactly. See, that's the trouble. It's exotic, but it's not honest. I mean, it's fancy, but it's not real. I mean, this is honest food. There's no lying in that beef. There's no insincerity in those potatoes. There's no deceit in the cauliflower. This is a totally honest meal.
And it's ridiculous. And it's also ridiculous that they remade it. And yeah. didn't work at all. But it's just insane, The Heartbreak Kid that it got. And Grodin is perfect in that too.
Yeah.
So creepy. And what a fantastic film. And then I went on a little binge of Grodin, because the next one I saw was Catch 22, where his very small role in Catch 22. But then I started to get a bit nerdy about it, and I thought, wow, is he the only, there can't be that big a number of people who've been directed both by Mike Nichols and Elaine May. it's got to be a small number, because Elaine May didn't direct that many films.
You know,
because her career, Ishtar killed her career, basically. But oh my
unfairly,
god,
unfairly, yeah.
And he was in Ishtar too.
Yes,
in Ishtar.
In Ishtar for a very short amount of time. And he's also the rare one who's been directed by Elaine May, Mike Nichols, Martin Brest, and Jim Henson. So
yes,
so.
Did you see So I Married an Axe Murderer? It's called So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Yeah,
the one that Mike Myers is in.
Yeah,
he plays the guy who doesn't want to have his car commandeered. No.
I wouldn't say, this is no insult to Mr. Grodin. I know he's no longer with us. I would say he has the greatest range. As an actor, he seems to play a type.
Yes.
Sort of intelligent, obviously, with simmering
rage. There's rage. Yes.
Issues, but if you you can nail that type and play it, you know, really well. That's a career.
Yes. Yeah. Another one I love is Seems Like Old Times, which I introduced Blake to earlier. Have you seen that one? Neil Simon wrote it. It's with him, Goldie Hawn, Chevy Chase. It's hilarious. Yeah.
But so whoever thought to put them together, De Niro and Grodin, it completely worked. I mean, there's so much for it. The casting kills it. It just they get the casting wrong, and it doesn't matter what else they do.
Mm-hmm.
It's just got off in the wrong. Again, we were talking about Excalibur earlier, and the casting is so wrong in Excalibur. Keen Arthur's just too old.
Mm-hmm.
40, and at one point he's playing like a 17-year-old. cast this very handsome man to play Lancelot. But
oh yeah, the hair. Yes, we talked about that.
But there's no chemistry at all between him and Guinevere. It just doesn't.
No.
Nothing going on. And was here in Midnight Run casting. I don't think they got a. I don't think they missed one. Like, everybody's perfect. Like
yeah. Yaphet Kotto, all of them. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
My God, Yaphet Kotto, so great in this.
Yeah.
Bullshit with the sunglasses, cigarettes, and
watch your cigarettes with this guy, Jack. John Ashton, too. John Ashton, my God.
Yeah. I wonder how much that was improvised, all that stuff. Because I know Yaphet would always come to the. I one of my favorite movies, and I have an encyclopedic memory of it, is Alien. Yeah. And Ridley Scott would always talk about how Yaphet was the biggest problem on the set.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because Yaphet would always come like 10 ideas. And Ridley Scott's firefighting throughout that whole film. He's just going, oh my God, I'm dealing with the producers and the set designers and the money people. And he's just firefighting. I'm just trying to get this thing in there. And Yaphet shows up, just go, I've got a whole bunch of ideas. Today, and Ridley Scott's going, oh yeah, but no, please,
just do the lines, please. We'll be back after this quick break.
Is there any way you and Harry Dean Stanton could just do the lines? And stay in your seats.
Talk about the most unhinged pairing of all time. Yaphet Kotto and Harry Dean Stanton. Fucking what wild cards. Bless their hearts.
Oh my gosh.
May they both rest in peace and power. Holy dooly. They're so good together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're perfect together. And I've always loved him since Alien. And when I was watching, I think he may have been the only one in Midnight Run that actually I'd seen in a film before.
Okay.
Well, Yaphet hated this experience, Adrian.
He
famously did not like. He thought
he didn't know it was a comedy.
He didn't know it was a comedy. He didn't know what was going on. He's like, I don't know if Martin Brest knows how to make movies. He just didn't get it. He just didn't get the exactly as you said. He couldn't pinpoint the tone of what he was going for. And then I imagine when he sees it, if he ever saw it or if he was too kind of burned by the experience. But when you see it, you're like, oh no, they got every take they needed with him. They got the serious tough guy that's completely undercut. You know, one of my favorite scenes, exactly as you talked about with the sunglasses, is like I found the tone of Midnight Run, or maybe refound it as I've gotten older, is the moment that Jack puts those sunglasses on. I know exactly what kind of movie this is. I'm like, I am in.
Right.
He puts those sunglasses on to mock Mosley and his team. I'm like, it's the best.
And also. That I didn't know that about Yaphet having problems with the, but that sometimes can work great.
He's supposed to be irritated. Yeah,
no wonder all the way through.
Yeah,
and that works great.
Yeah, you know?
It's like supposedly, I don't know if this is true, but supposedly Sam Peckinpah would do that a lot with his cast. He would say, you know, the guy doesn't think you're a very good actor. And he goes, well, yeah, he just says, you know, it's going to be a real drag to work with you today because he doesn't think you're very good. And he goes, all right, action. And the guy is like simmering with rage.
Oh, my God.
Incredibly tense scene. And then, of course, Peckinpah the next day would just go, oh, my God, you see your buddy, your scene partner's performance was so great yesterday. And you were so down. He doesn't think you're a good actor. And he would just do this.
What a shit. Yeah. What a shit.
All the way through with his cast. And
nobody's sleeping. Yeah. It
works. I mean, if you show up to the set
angry,
you know. Like one of my favorite, this is another Alien sidetrack, but one of my favorite bits when you're watching that, they made a 3.5-hour documentary about the making of Alien, if you ever catch it.
Yeah.
Called The Beast Within, and it's as good as the film. It's so entertaining. But there's a really great bit in where Ridley Scott is just had it up to here with Yaphet and everybody else. And he says on Yaphet's final day, And also, you can see this exactly happening. Yaphet was so into the movie. Like, he was so into his character and everything that was happening to everybody around the movie. He says, on Yaphet's final day, he came to me and he grabbed my arm and he said, I'm not going to die today, Ridley. I'm not going to die today. He says, and Ridley Scott says, how? What's going to happen? He says, I'm going to kill that monster and I'm going to save the crew. And Ridley says,
oh my God.
I'm going to kill him and I'm going to save the crew. And this is how I'm going to do it. And he was so worked up and he just wanted to save everybody. And this is awesome. You know,
That's amazing.
He didn't want Veronica Cartwright to die. He didn't want
to
die. He wanted to save everybody and save them from the monster. And he was convinced that he could right to the end. In one way, that's bananas. I mean, that's really bar. But in another way, how great is that?
That is, yeah.
He's not just showing up for
in character. Like, I'm going to do it. Yes.
Henry's like, nah, you're going to die, and I'm going to kill you on screen.
I'm afraid not yet. But it's not going to happen. But yeah, he's so good in this and everything, and Blue Collar.
I was just going to say Blue Collar. Yeah.
What was that James Bond movie he was in?
Live and Let Die.
Which also is another tonally weird film.
It's so strange. It's like, yeah.
There's really camp comedy.
Yeah.
From Roger Moore, and then dark, dark, weird stuff, and then there's the whole Shaft stuff.
But that's Bond doing. That's Bond
in the 70s.
Bond does that thing where for a few of those years, it's just like the I'll have what she's having action series. It's like whatever is big in action, whatever the trend is, it kind of has to do an incorporation and sort of almost consume it. It's like, okay, well, we're gonna take some of that into this next one.
Like Moonraker.
Moonraker, of course.
Yeah.
The worst example of that. Just go, can we have Bond doing Star Wars? No, we can't.
They can.
Throw his ass in space. Yeah.
Why not? It's shot in England, it's shot in London on Pinewood. We're gonna take some Star Wars here. We're gonna do it.
You know, it's so funny when you Pauline Kael. This is another sidetrack. I hope you don't mind, but Pauline Kael famously hated Kubrick. I mean, she hated Stanley Kubrick. And if you ever read her review of 2001: A Space Odyssey, it's, you know, they make some fair points, but a lot of it's quite unhinged.
Yes.
One of the most unhinged parts of that review is the bit where she talks about the special effects in Thunderball being better than the special effects in 2001: A Space Odyssey.
It's a take that hasn't aged well.
No, and I just go, really? Thunderball?
Go watch that again, Pauline. Yes.
With the guy floating, pretending to float on the wires, and then the thing, like, and you're just going, I'm not so sure. I think maybe your hatred for Kubrick has blinded you to the reality here.
That's the edge. Like Pauline Kael, one of the greatest film critics of all time. It's like there is a fine line between where Pauline Kael's hatred takes her off into the unhinged. Like she starts to get to Armand White territory where it's like 2 + 2 = 5, where you're like, I don't understand how someone who has a command of the English language as well as you is gone so bad on this particular take. And then there's other ones where she eviscerates a film and you're like, I actually can't ever watch that movie again because she told you every conceivable flaw in it in such a profound way that it like hits your bones. Like she's like autopsy to corpse and it's over.
Well, to bring it back to Serpico and Pacino, in one of his interviews in the 70s, which I love, he had read that Pauline Kael famously said he looked like Dustin Hoffman or something, and he took such umbrage to it in an interview. He goes, is that before or after they removed the shot glass from her throat?
Really funny.
I love that, yes.
if you're gonna praise special effects in Thunderball,
yeah, put on some glasses, Pauline Kael. Like, yeah,
praise that giant set they built in the volcano.
Yeah,
yeah,
That's incredible. That's the basis of all the Austin Powers movies, and just anybody who's ever built a giant set, just because, mm-hmm. well, they did Thunderball. Look what they did. They had the inside of a volcano in some studio west of London. Praise that. Don't praise the shonky space stuff, which no one can watch now without cringing. But, you know, the volcano, that's amazing.
But no, what's amazing is Robert De Niro running after a biplane and like jumping on and pulling a man out of the biplane while practical, it's running along. Yeah. Practical effects, practical running to locations. Catch a train, mm-hmm. helicopters, crashing cars, huge set pieces where people are in real danger to do the stunts. That's the stuff where I get, that's my kind of jam. It's like people have put such dedication into this that they're going to sort of safely, but probably not, because the 80s, I would imagine, are slightly less crazy with health and safety on a set than we are. But yeah, absolutely incredible in this, in particular in Midnight Run, to go back. There's no volcano, but Dennis Farina wears snappy suits.
I think you made a good point about the train stuff, because that's the scene where they run onto the train. Mm-hmm. But it's actually the actors.
Yes.
And the freight train's not going very fast. But there's so much possibility for things to go wrong there.
Yes.
Like, you could fall flat on your face. You could run into the train. You could get between the train and the
God. Yes.
And this is your leading man. And
your leading man, too. Yeah. It's the whole movie is right there in that train carriage.
And they just say, there's going to be this scene where you have to run up to and jump. And you know how they do it now? You would have them running into the thing, into the boxcar, and then then you would see them landing in the boxcar in a close-up.
The stunt people did it. Yeah,
or you would, you know, long shot, and you'd see two anonymous guys jumping in, mm-hmm. and it would be all stuntmen, because it's just the insurance and everything else.
Oh, my God. Yeah,
can't do this. But there they actually, I just think stuff with trains really freaks me out, because there's so much potential for things to go wrong. Mm-hmm. And getting on and off trains, get in and out of trains.
And in the water too. I know that was really dicey. They had to shoot some of that over in New Zealand, actually, because it was too cold in Arizona, and it was dangerous, and it was like, uh-oh. Like, Grodin was supposed to go in the water first, and at the last minute, he's like, De Niro, like, you go ahead and you do it. And after De Niro got out, he said, no, you're not doing it. Like, it was too bad. Yeah.
But interspersed between those action scenes, I'm just thinking, there's all those character beats, because
yes,
before the train bit is the bit with the currency.
The litmus configuration, yeah.
So fantastic.
Yes.
What are they gonna do? What are they gonna do? They invent this whole thing, and it's beautiful. It's like it's bonding. So written, it's so gorgeous, and it's so, and the joke at the very end, when he's got the money belt. So none of it. It reminded me of the joke from Roger Rabbit. When he's sewing the handcuffs to get out of the handcuffs. And then when he finally gets through the handcuffs, Roger Rabbit just slips his hand out of the handcuffs.
Yes.
Bob Hoskins says to Roger Rabbit, you mean you could have taken your hand out at any time? And Roger Rabbit says, no, only when it was funny. and that's like Charles Grodin. Charles Grodin could have opened the money belt
at any time. Yep.
At any point and save them, but only at the end does he do it, when it's funny, because you've watched all the other stuff, you just go, oh, that's so perfect.
Yes.
They had all this stuff up, they did all this hard work and all these gags and everything, and then you have this little thing at the end. It's so great. And again, only someone like Grodin could really have pulled that off.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Temperament and, you know, character and stuff like that. It's just great, great stuff.
And I love how much physical stuff kind of contradicts the dialogue, like that scene where he's on the phone and he's like, and I'm going to kill the Duke. And then,
yeah,
you know, like when he vibes, like, I love that so much. Yeah.
Just the initial thing with the plane. When physical comedy.
Things go down. Yeah.
I underestimate him as an actor because that is really great comic acting.
Yes.
These
things go down. I love it.
Yeah. Not everybody could have pulled that off.
No.
That's really
good. Try being a fan of this movie and being on a plane and not wanting to say that line. And you're like, oh God, just don't say it.
Don't say it.
Don't fucking say it. You're going to get kicked off this flight.
The film is a hit. Everybody liked it. And Hollywood eats its own. How come there was never a Midnight Run 2?
Well, there was.
There were these direct to USA Network sequels, but they had Christopher McDonald in for Robert De Niro. It's not his fault, but they were not great. Yeah. I don't
know about those. You got to tell me about those. So when did they come out in the 90s? 2000?
Yes. I've only seen one of them because I did buy a box set of the DVDs that came as a set, and I watched the first one and it was not good. Dan Hedaya is in for Joey Pants, and oh man, it's a mess.
So and it comes out in the first one's 1994, another Midnight Run.
Okay,
and they have catchy titles too, Adrian, like Midnight Runaround.
Straight to video.
Straight to video.
USA Network.
Yeah, straight to USA Network, then video. Then there's Midnight Runaround, which is another made for television, also 1994. So they made them like back to back.
Yeah.
And then the final one was Midnight Run for Your Life. So they made three movies in 1 year. Basically like bloated television episodes. And they're only 90
they
minutes.
They redress the same warehouse. No.
Pretty much. And so I'm actually waiting as we speak for the box set to watch them, but they've been so hard to get in Australia that I've had to ship them internationally to come here, and so I can actually watch them.
I was just making three movies in 1 year is not normally a sign of quality, but then Peter Jackson's yelling, just going, "Well, I did it."
Yeah.
over a few years, Pete.
Yeah, we can do it. Oh my God, I had no idea about those. And now I kind of wish I hadn't known about
it. It ruined it. Yeah.
I do like Dan Hedaya, though.
Dan Hedaya is good. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There was that 90s period where he was just in everything. Yeah.
9 to 5 and Blood Simple and you know, a million different things. And great in all those.
Yes.
Yeah.
Playing the creepy boss, lover. Dude, you know, he's so good. He's got an interesting look, you know.
Well, he takes over the Joey Pants role,
right? Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, okay, so at least they got some good cast in there. But who? Oh yeah, so De Niro. Oh, what about none of the other minor characters returned? They
I only watched one, and like I've kind of removed it from my memory. I don't know.
Jaws 2, they brought back Chief Brody. Jaws 3, I don't remember. But Jaws 4, I totally remember because they brought back Brody's wife and Michael Caine. You know,
that movie's only famous for Michael Caine's line about it, which is like,
yeah,
it's like, have you ever seen it? House. No, I haven't seen it, but I saw the house it built.
Yeah.
Bless his heart.
There's one more gag. He must have told this in Parkinson or something, but he says, "Why did you decide to do Jaws 4? And it said, "Well, I opened up the script and it said exterior Bahamas morning," and I, okay, I was in rainy London in February, and I thought, okay, exterior Bahamas morning, yeah, all right,
I can do that, yeah,
easy,
I could do that, yeah. But yeah,
and they would actually shoot it there back then. Yeah, yeah. It wasn't like, you know, Santa Fe, New Mexico for the Bahamas or something. Yeah,
you did it well because the shark follows them from New England to the Bahamas.
Yeah,
that happens. Yeah,
of
they're like serial killers. These sharks in these movies. Yes,
it knows that she's left Martha's Vineyard.
It's the Hannibal Lecter of sharks. Yeah.
I'm having an old friend for dinner. That's basically Jaws 4.
I'm gonna follow it. Yes.
They've gone 1,400 miles south. But also, think of their decision making. They Martha's Vineyard. It's apocalyptic and it's bad memories. So they could move to Arizona, and they're not going to be troubled by sharks of any kind.
Come to Phoenix. We could hang.
Denver's nice. Why not Wyoming? Just no water.
No. But she says, "Oh no, I won't go that far." And to avoid having sharks terrorize my family, got a beach house. Completion. Now that you've mentioned those Midnight Run movies, you know, I know I'm going to watch them because I've got this little thing inside my head. And so I know at some point I'm going to be sitting down and watching them through, hating them probably. But once you've started, it's like the way I embraced the first Hobbit movie and really didn't like it, and then knew I would be back in the cinema for 2 and 3, hating myself for going there and hating the film, but I knew I'd have to do it.
You're a completist. Yes, well, after I watch them on DVD, I'll like mail them your way and then you can watch them next.
And Jen's like, then they're not in my house anymore, so I don't have to save their DVD cabinet.
Just don't take with you in your completest journey. I remember taking to a Planet of the Apes marathon, and she was not impressed.
I can't see that you would be.
How many more of these? That's going. Oh, don't worry.
There's 5 of them. No,
more still to come. And then years from now, Tim Burton and a whole bunch of other people are going to reboot the franchise for us. But I think she left and never spoke to me again.
Oh, that's hilarious. This has been Midnight Run Through with Blake Howard and Jen Johans. We'll be back next week with another episode, but until then...
See you in the next life. See you in the next life.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.